HPPodCraft.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the very first HPPodCraft.com comments show.
We are going to be covering the comments on the shows of Sathagua, Burial of the Rats, and the first Bartleby the Scrivener.
If you have some thoughts about what we're doing here on these stories, please write in. I would say go over to Patreon, if you're not already a subscriber, and check out the comments that are coming in over there, because folks are really participating. I know that some folks are a little sad that we will eventually be retiring the Witch House media system.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of comments there. There are a lot of discussions going on there. Again, if you want to stay active there for a couple more months, just let us know and we'll reactivate you. But let's just try and get the discussion going over in the new space.
Yeah. And I want to hear what everybody has to say, because this is a group effort. We're a team, all of us.
That's right. At some point, I'm going to move in with one of you.
Yeah, that's going to be the $300 pledge you get to pay to have Chet Piper live at your house.
See if you love us so much after that's happened.
Our first story is Sathagua, and we are going to read the comments. First one, this is from Joe Peterson. He says, I'm a longtime fan, but sorry guys, this episode was unlistenable with all the profanity and political rants. I hope that never happens again.
Okay, starting off with a contentious one.
Yeah.
I gotta say that most people were pretty into that episode and pretty happy about it. But I wanted to address this one just because I have a mea culpa to begin with the profanity.
Sure.
And that we didn't really indicate in the show notes or anywhere in the show that that was going to happen.
We should have.
And we probably should have, although it was a unique situation because we tend to keep profanity out of the show or bleep it out.
Yes.
Because we know folks listen with their families and it's just easier for us to avoid that. But in this situation, we didn't really get a lot of primer time. You know, we didn't make Patton aware of that.
No.
So he came in to do it and just talked however he wanted to talk. And then when we were in the edit, if you bleeped that stuff, that ended up sounded way dirtier than what he was actually saying. I mean, I actually started doing that and went, this sounds like he's saying some really screwed up stuff. And on top of that, I thought about putting a little comment in the beginning of the show that said, warning, some explicit content. That also made it sound like much more horrible things were going to happen than actually did, because it was really just the F word.
It was the F word a lot.
At the end of the day, I thought, you know what? This is a pretty adult story anyway.
It is.
Without saying anything about this, let's just see how folks react to it. And a couple of people were like, whoa, that's a lot of F-bombs. But for the most part, people didn't seem to care.
Mm-hmm.
But I am sorry that we didn't indicate it. Our regular show will still have bleeps and be family friendly.
Yeah.
When he says, I hope that never happens again, well, we've got a couple more episodes with Patton,
yeah,
and they will probably also be explicit, just in terms of the language.
Yes.
Now, with the political rants, I do disagree with that. I don't think that we got political.
I don't think we did either, and I haven't re-listened to it. Maybe there was something that was said, but Chad and I tried very diligently to not get political on the show and just keep politics out of it. But social issues do come up, especially things like racism.
Yeah.
And if being racist or not being racist is something you would consider political, I would say you're nuts, because that is something I think everybody agrees that racism is bad.
Like in this country, both political parties, I think that that's the position they,
yeah,
they have.
Yeah.
You know?
Republicans and Democrats both say racism is bad.
It certainly, I thought it might ruffle some feathers because people get uncomfortable around those topics, but it seemed very important to discuss that in the context of the author because it comes up whether we like it or not. So kind of have to tackle that.
Oh, yeah.
But if it did offend you, sorry. We, like Chris just said, we try to, you know, I think last year we were doing one of the comedy quiz shows and we started writing all of our jokes for it and all of them were coming out political just because that's just,
yeah,
you know, what's in the air, and we had to discuss with each other. Wait, because we never really explicitly talked about it.
No.
But wait, why don't we address this stuff on the show? I mean, we do have points of view. I think we all agreed, well, it's because that's all you hear.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just constant, this deluge of opinion. And you want to have places you can go to just enjoy
some literature,
whatever it is you're into, some literature, and not have those things intrude. I did make a joke about John Bolton's mustache, but I think that that was a joke about his political appearance.
Because that has nothing to do with his politics. Yeah, it's just that Banksy's got a big walrus mustache. That was just the guy that I saw recently, or that you saw recently, that had a big bushy mustache, and that's why
exactly.
It was funny.
Anyway, I don't want people to think that we're going down some path like that on the show. We're going to keep politics out of it. The other reason I don't like getting in there is I don't like talking about too many, even though we talk about current movies and stuff every once in a while, I like to try and keep it a little timeless, you know, timeless. It's so pretentious to say, but I mean, you know, just, you know, less of the moment so that if you listen to one of these shows in a couple of years, you don't go, oh.
I do have to point out, Chad, that most of our references are to things in the 80s and 90s. So there are probably people that listen to this that have no idea what we're talking about.
Well, yeah, sometimes I got to go, wait a minute, let's stop. The older we get, too, the more I go, wait.
Yeah.
We shouldn't make comments about this because millennials aren't going to know what we're talking about.
Joke about, like, Stocker Channing. People are going to go, what? Who's that?
Yeah, exactly. this guy, T.E. Ogden, I don't know, I guess this was a response to that comment he wrote.
Yeah.
While I will agree that H.P. Podcraft is a sacred thing and politics have no place here, Patton Oswalt did bring some choice literary recommendations and thoughtful analysis to the episode. I have a feeling even if you held a gun to his head and told him not to get political, you would be cleaning up his brain matter within the first 5 minutes, though. Still one of my favorite episodes yet, and great story choice. That is true. We didn't say don't talk about politics. But he did right away correct himself when he said, not even about politics. There just seems like to be something strange in the air right now. So I think he was aware that we don't need to go down the road on that stuff.
Yeah.
And in future episodes, we certainly did not. So,
yeah.
So if you're worried about the politics, it's not going to come up.
So David Kellogg says, this was an amazing episode. I've listened twice. One question, the version of the story you linked to gets the following review on Amazon. Skips passages, repeats others, unintelligible and impossible to read. Is the text okay? Follow up to previous question, there is an ebook called Demiurge, The Complete Cthulhu Mythos Tales of Michael Shea, available on Kindle. That seems to have most of the Shea stories that we are going to cover on the show. I have the Kindle stories. I've read them. I didn't see any problems with it. But then again, I'm not very smart.
Well, I read the stories in the book from Perilous Press,
yeah.
Copying Squid and other weird fiction. I don't think you and I had any points of contention between your text and mine. So I do think it's okay. If you folks are interested in Copying Squid, you should write Perilous Press if you can and see if they'll start republishing that hardcover that has the S.T. Joshi intro to it. It might be out of print. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't cheap for me to get it. I'm a cheapskate, so I did pony up like $30 to get it because I just wanted, you know, to commemorate how cool it was to have Patton on the show.
£23 here in the UK.
Here's a comment from the good heathen. Patton is a wonder and a treasure. Happy he could be part of this episode. You guys finally getting to Michael Shea brought up some serious nostalgia in the more murky parts of my brain. When I was in high school back in the late 90s, Shea's short story, The Autopsy, and Uncle Tug's were on the reading lists. A lot of people mentioned that, Uncle Tug's. Yeah. I think Patton was saying Uncle Tug. It's actually Uncle Tug's.
Mm-hmm.
Before anyone asks, I was in a private Catholic school that was extremely progressive. Along with an extensive list of short stories, we also read The Shining, The Exorcist, and The Elementals.
What? I mean, so,
yeah, that is a strange
that's super
reading list.
Progressive, yeah.
That's really progressive. Excellent episode, and I will choke up the cash to get a copy of that near-perfect collection of Michael Shea shorts. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And yeah, I want to find out more about the school's curriculum. That's pretty interesting.
So Nicholas Moore says, I was always under the assumption that Robert E. Howard created Sethagua in the story The Black Stone, first without name, only referring to the grotesque toad-like creature in his tale The Master of the Monolith. And Smith just ran with Howard's creation, eventually giving the squat and pot-bellied monstrous toad, as Smith similarly describes it in The Tale of Satapra Zeros, the hideous name we now know and love. However, I just noticed that both stories were published side by side in the November 1931 issue of Weird Tales. And then listener John F. Rocker jumps in and says, that story was written in 1929, but published in Weird Tales in 31.
The Tale of Satapra Zeros was written in 29.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is, I mean, just from third-party sources that I've read, that they say that's definitely where the creature was created. But it is interesting because it says that original comment from Nicholas Moore says, baffling matters even more. I read that Howard and Smith most likely had not started a correspondence with one another until late 1932, so a year after these two stories with Sethagua came out.
Right.
Maybe Lovecraft was the go-between to get that stuff going.
It could be.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I am pretty sure at least the name was created by Clark Ashton Smith. But if anybody knows more about this, chime in on that conversation under Sethagua.
Rickard says, in modern takes on mythos, I often find myself annoyed that either the supernatural is so subtle that you might as well not bother, or it's overt a la Lumley. This story found a really nice balance of mind-blowing surreal things happening and distinct old one presence without diminishing the mythos. Patton really told it well, too. He followed us all this way. Can't we keep him? Please?
I hope so. Like I say, we got two more shows with them, but then after that, we're going to have to schedule again. So
yes,
I hear you on that comment. A lot of times horror is so mismanaged when you know, it's the modern stuff where it's just gross or gory, or it turns the mythos stuff into a slasher film.
Yeah.
Or it's so weird tales where nothing happens at all. So this was a nice balance. I do have to say he won me over on these stories a little bit. I was a little skeptical when I first started reading them.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't sure if the horror was cosmic enough.
Yeah.
And then the way he described it, I mean, you hear it in the episode. I clearly wasn't understanding it quite. And then the way he filled it out.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. This is what the author was doing.
There's a bit of it that kind of made me feel like it was not so much about conceptual horror as it was about like the fear of being eaten, which I felt like that was a more realistic fear. I mean, it's possible that some animal could eat you, especially like a snake or something like that, while you're conscious even. And that's pretty horrific to think about, but I wouldn't say that's an unknowable fear.
Yeah.
All of the other things that Shea puts in that story really do bring it to that cosmic level of terror.
Scarred Dude says, this is without a doubt one of the best episodes to date. More mythos goodness and a new guest couldn't be happier. While the social commentary seemed to be quite accurate, I would be remiss if I did not point out that Thomas Jefferson tried to abolish slavery 3 times. History professors sometimes forget that. Still, I am excited for more Michael Shea. Can't wait for Sthagua Part 2 episode.
Yeah, that's true. Thomas Jefferson did try to abolish slavery, but his behavior with slavery and the things that he did, I mean, he owned slaves up until he died, and he didn't even release all of the slaves that he owned after his death. Some he did, others he didn't. He had debts that needed to get paid off, so he sold human beings. I don't give him a pass for trying to abolish slavery. It's a different time. Things were very complicated. And if you go to Wikipedia, there is a whole huge entry on Thomas Jefferson and slavery. If you just type that into Wikipedia, mm-hmm. and it goes into, I mean, he bounces all over the place. And of course, it's extremely complicated.
Yeah. So, I mean, thanks for pointing that out. I think that helps make the case that this is something worth discussing because it's so inconsistent with people's attitudes. Here you have a guy who owned all these slaves who also tried to abolish it. That doesn't even make any sense. Yeah. Why wouldn't you, in your personal behavior, do what you're trying to advocate? But ideally, a lot of the founding fathers wanted to get rid of the institution. They called it America's original sin. They knew it was horrible. Mm-hmm. But culturally, it was so entrenched in the society that they would do it even though they're speaking out against it. And that's how so many of these behaviors are. And why it's so difficult to just either say, oh, that person's an asshole, so we'll never talk about them again.
Mm-hmm.
Or to say, well, they were just a product of their time, so you can't blame them for it. I mean, it really has got to be somewhere in between, right?
Yeah.
Where you say, you know, they were struggling with it. There were evil actions and noble attempts.
Yeah, but you can also point out, this is what people say about Lovecraft, at that time, there were hardcore abolitionists, people that were willing to fight and go to the mat to combat slavery.
Right.
Those guys didn't.
Well, it was nice that Patton pointed out how Lovecraft is the archetype of the young racist.
You know? Yeah.
He's sheltered. He has not been in an ethnically variated place or had real experiences with people of different mm-hmm. backgrounds. And so he forms these dumb ideas.
Stupid.
While also being a fantastic writer that created this whole great mythology. So, you know, these are complicated topics. I'm all for getting them out there instead of...
I think that we should definitely talk about them as they come up.
But I do understand when people say, God, is that all we're going to talk about, right? I do understand the knee-jerk annoyance by fans who go, oh, here we go.
Sure.
You know, I'm not saying right off the issue, but I do get it when people roll their eyes and go, how many times are we going to address this? You know,
we've done over 400 episodes. How often do we talk about this? Really?
Right.
All right. So let's get on to Burial of the Rats.
I have a feeling that in these comments shows, we're going to come up the hero every time. I don't know why. Just feels like
we're right. Everyone else is wrong. If we're wrong, I like to think that we come correct about things.
Yeah, of course.
Hopefully you'll keep us to task on this stuff, listeners.
Let's talk about Burial of the Rats. Cacodemoniacal says, I am now fully compliant and on board with the regime change. I like the way that you, your use of language there.
Regime.
Compliance. Please, people, compliance. I guess things could always be worse. We could be trying to live by raking through the burnt refuse of the city with little rakes.
Yeah.
It's true. Puts things in perspective. I've had rats as pets and have come to believe that people and rats have a lot in common, especially the fact that our upbringing determines how nice we are going to be.
Rats, just like dogs, people say dogs are bad or dogs are good. It really just depends on how you raise them generally, just like people.
I say get them into law school as quickly as possible. I had a friend that had pet rats, and they were pretty, they had little personalities and, but I didn't like to hold them. You know, he'd say, do you want to,
Yeah.
Well, what do you think I was going to say?
Well, I don't like holding little dogs even.
Is it because of the little bones?
Yeah, the little bones and the little skin and it's just, like.
There's something I feel like I'm going to crush them or, and then on top of that, those rats have those really thick tails that are always kind of whipping around and stuff and grosses me out.
Whipping around.
Yeah. Whoopsh,
whoopsh. Oh, golly. So Richard Horstman says, when they explained what the Burial of the Rats actually is, it made me think that Stoker had probably heard of Sky Burial, which I had not heard of. So I looked up Sky Burial and it says it is a funeral practice in which human corpse is placed on a mountaintop to decompose while exposed to the elements or to be eaten by scavenging animals, especially carrion birds. It is a specific type of general practice of excarnation.
That's a new word for me. Excarnation, also known as defleshing. Well, if you've got a word like defleshing, why the hell would you use excarnation? Defleshing is one of the coolest words I've ever read.
Yeah, totally cool word.
Yeah, I guess, burial in that context doesn't have to mean putting somebody in the ground. I mean, I think that's what it means, and I was making fun of it. But people say burial at sea. It just means the process of disposing of a body. So, yeah, sky burial, that's interesting.
Denny Lawlor says, you guys are insanely funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could listen... And I think I could listen to the two of you talk about literally anything. Keep it up. funny that you mentioned that, because this month we're going to be releasing our bonus show where we're going to talk about something that we don't normally talk about. You'll have to wait till next week to hear what that is.
And then we can decide whether you want to go back and delete that comment or not. David Kellogg writes, you may know that guillotines are used to kill rats in neuroscience labs.
No.
Thought it was a joke. He goes, actual tiny guillotines. Better than drugs if you need to examine brain slices later.
Wow.
I thought, are you serious? Looked up guillotine. He's totally right. You can buy them online. They're everywhere. They look like little cigar cutters or something.
Oh, God.
It looks like something you would just have on your desk, you know?
Jeez,
unfortunately, it doesn't look like the little French Revolution guillotine, but he's right. A little triangle, you poke that rat's head through and done.
Oh, God. So David Kellogg says, great episode. I think every time you guys come up with a new great term or phrase, Chris's was, of course, poo milk. Chad's was Hobo Boatman, which was a great name for a folk metal band.
I agree. Maybe I might have had the, there's an old song called Volga Boatman.
Oh.
Old Russian song that Glenn Miller's orchestra played it, and so I was familiar with that. So maybe that was in my head, I don't know. But
could be.
Yeah, go get out there and start it. Hobo Boatman, you can have that.
It's yours.
Nobody ever say poo milk again because I hate it.
You know, John Hancock on Twitter, he had some hay with poo milk. It was pretty good.
Robert Skunblad Anderson. He's got an umlaut over the O, so I don't know if I did that right or not. But Robert wrote, great episode. When I read the story before listening to the show, the narrator felt pretty unreliable. I just had a feeling he was paranoid about that friendly old couple and that he just imagined people hanging around outside the shack. When he jumped through the wall, the place burned down, killing the two of them. Of course, the neighbors would chase him after that.
Yeah.
And when he reached the authorities, they would naturally believe a rich guy rather than those poor dust diggers.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is a good point. I mean, maybe he got paranoid over nothing.
I didn't get that impression reading the story, but now that you pointed out, that seems plausible.
We see it happen all the time where people get sketched out and then they assume that, right? There's all kinds of stuff like that happening, or people getting outraged about that in the U.S. right now because somebody called the cops on a bunch of black people who are barbecuing, right? And that's a thing that people are mad about. Or a black guy was asleep in a library and they called the police on him, So it's that same kind of thing where you're like, I think this is sketchy and nothing's going on. That is an interesting point of view. John also commented, you'd think the commissary would have considered that the bones might be warm because somebody burnt the shack down, which I thought was funny.
Oh, golly. Yeah, John does a live game podcast, and he's just a funny guy. He's a real...
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get that on the show because he just reads creepy stuff, but man, that guy is super funny. And follow him on Twitter. He usually writes good stuff as well.
He's awesome, yeah.
Big Jack Brass.
Big Jack Brass on Twitter. Rafe Ball writes, the narrator's interaction with the old woman in her hut is reminiscent of Harker's with Dracula at his castle, both first feeling like a welcome guest, then coming to the realization they are trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Though this narrator, Kool-Aid Manning his way out of the hut, is a bit more action-packed. Congratulations.
Kool-Aid Manning.
I think that's the title of this comments show. Kool-Aid Manning.
That is, oh, God.
Kool-Aid Manning sounds like that would be a pro football player, you know?
Brent Kool-Aid Manning.
I agree with Robert that I thought there might be two sides to the story. It was a shame that the old woman was dead, as I was quite looking forward to her trying to explain her perspective. Well, officer, I invited this young man into my hut, and we spent hours having a friendly discussion. Then when we lit the lantern, as it had gotten so late and dark, he went crazy! Jumped up and charged straight through the wall of my hut, he did, and ran off into the night. Just look at what's left of my poor home! We thought that he might have taken leave of his senses. There is no place to run about in the pitch of night. You might easily trip and break your neck. So my kindly neighbor set off in search of him before he had a mishap. When we heard him fall into the water, we even sent out the rowboat to try and save him. What? No, that was a rescue axe. And Francois has a pathological hatred of sombreros. Good work, Rafe. I think that's exactly what the account would have been had she survived.
Perfect. Baylin's 999 says, as a longtime wanderer on a round-the-world trip, I too have occasionally questioned the taxi I'm in, the person I'm talking to, or the establishment I enter as possibly less friendly than assumed. To wit, the wise wayfarer is cautious, and if not, it's death by rats.
It's true. I've jumped into some cabs only to realize they were gypsy cabs before.
What? What does that mean?
Not gypsy. Well, you know, that it wasn't really pre-Uber.
Yeah.
Actually, it happened to me in London. I was the...
Oh, unlicensed cabs.
I didn't expect the subways to shut down.
Yeah.
That was, to me, I thought that the tube would be open all night. I don't know why I thought that. I probably should have checked up on it. But we were down somewhere and needed to get somewhere else and went over to the station and the gate was closed. And so anyway, we were looking for a cab and a guy came by, we jumped in his car. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that he didn't have a meter. He didn't, yeah. You know, and then he took advantage of us being Americans by charging, way overcharging us. And I still hadn't figured out the exchange rate very well. So I ended up giving him too much dough. So yes, that's true. Be very wary while you're traveling, but don't be so wary that you Kool-Aid man out of anywhere. Unnecessarily. Bartleby the Scrivener. A couple comments on that, even though it just came out a couple days ago. Yeah. Sellers Burgener says, hey guys, enjoying the new content, and I know you like suggestions for discussion. One thing that I think is relevant to weird fiction is the literary concept of purple prose. In the classical world, it was seen as a good thing. In the screenplay world, it is a bad thing. Once purple was the rarest dye of the Praetorian Guard's cloaks made of crushed sea snails. A slew of descriptive adjectives was the literary analog. Now it is a burden to the reader. Clark Ashton Smith and Lovecraft clearly disagreed. When did we become so jaded? That's an interesting question.
When I was 28.
When you were 28 is when we all became so jaded?
Yes. All of humanity. Wow. No, just me.
I think there's a few reasons that's occurred. I would guess that it begins with literacy rates.
Mm-hmm.
Folks used to be far more illiterate. Reading and writing were the tools of a more educated class. And I think they, being highly educated, would have more fun with those things or try to make a lot of allusions and use all of their vocabulary. And not, you know, if you think about 1820, only 12% of the people in the world could read and write.
Wow.
Now, only 17% of the world remains illiterate. So those, that completely flipped.
Yeah.
And so I think the more population you have to appeal, the more people, it's better to have simpler ideas come across in simpler language. Honestly, I feel like that is a big contributor to it, where reading became less of something that only highly educated people could do and something that's more available. What do you think? Am I crazy?
No, I think you're right. Exactly. Now, a lot of people use reading practically just to kind of get through their days and to get information and to share ideas with each other.
Yeah.
And you kind of want to get to the meat of it. They read something to get the content and not necessarily appreciate the act of reading.
Yeah, there's that. And I do. And there was, around the time Lovecraft was writing, there was a huge shift in what people were looking for that switched towards simplicity and cutting out all the artifice and getting right to the point. But also that in and of itself suggests so many other possibilities. I mean, when you read Ernest Hemingway, it's the simplest, most muscular writing there is out there. But there's so much suggested between the lines. Mm-hmm. And this became a new way to express yourself is by not saying too much.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. So I don't know if it's a measure of being jaded.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly in the screenplay world, I know what you're saying. If you write a screenplay, leave all that out. But that's because that none of those words are going to go up on screen. So you just got to get the action out there in a very readable way.
It's a visual medium.
But that's a good comment. And I think there's probably more to it than that.
Yeah.
But definitely, yeah, public tastes, things that are hard to get through aren't as possible.
Yeah, you know, and also I want to say that people probably don't have as much leisure time. Like the people that were reading were the wealthy people, and those wealthy people had a lot more leisure time. So they could take their time and spend an afternoon reading a short story and thinking about it. And whereas most people, even nowadays, don't have that much leisure time, or they, if they do, it's not just books anymore. You've got movies, television shows, video games,
right,
and all the other things like going out into nature or camping or walking or, you know, all these things battling over your time. Do you really want to sit down and spend a few hours going over a very purple short story?
You know, I do if it's really good, but you run the risk of it not being worth your time.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's that too. Richard Horseman writes on discussion topics, any thoughts on how you'd like to cover some of the longer stuff cited in supernatural horror and literature? Like Melmoth the Wanderer is great, but it would take multiple months to get through. Yeah, we've exhausted most of the short stories from supernatural horror and literature, and we do have a few novels in there that we could go after. But
For us, doing a novel is a lot more work. Covering a short story, they're usually between like 12 and 18 pages, sometimes 20 is kind of the length of it.
Yeah.
And if we break down a novel, which can be, you know, a couple hundred into four episodes, we're, you know, basically breaking 50 pages into a half hour show. So for us to kind of compress that and process it and go through it and find what's interesting about it, it's way more work. We usually only tackle the ones that we really like and are really willing to jump into and give it the time.
Yeah, that are really seminal.
Yeah.
You know, Dracula, Frankenstein, Jekyll and Hyde.
Lurker at the Threshold.
Lurker at the Threshold. What a book. But no, you never know. We might come around to doing those. I'm not sure, but we certainly... I was thinking about it when we read Poroth Farm because he mentioned some of those longer works. But he also mentions that they're incredibly boring, which kind of also put me off. So
yeah.
I don't know. So you say, any thoughts? Yes, we have thoughts. Do we have any decisions? No.
No.
Don't sit around waiting for those long romantic books for too long. We have a flesh out schedule for the rest of the year, but I know the only... We've got a couple novels on there. Phantom of the Opera I want to do.
Yes.
Maybe around Christmas time.
Also, Richard says that over 900 patrons already. Great. The academic and Professor Tears got snapped up. Noise.
Yes.
I want to bring this up to you guys out there. Chad and I are trying to think of other things that we can offer at higher levels. So if you're somebody that has money to burn and wants to think of some cool stuff that you would like us to do, let us know.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do it.
Yeah, we're not sure yet. I mean, we've got to get the feel for this new workflow this month. And then as we settle into that schedule and make sure this is all even viable, then we'll start adding stuff.
Exactly.
So now's the time to let us know what you'd like to hear from us if we were to offer up some of those higher levels. This is from Nate. He said, okay, I had my doubts about Bartleby when I realized y'all would be covering it. We read the story about 10 years ago in high school, and though I wasn't a huge fan, it has stuck with me over the years. For listening to this podcast, I realize how much the story belongs on your show. Your commentary is making me understand why it has been so hard to shake off. Good call, MIT guy.
Yeah, it's great. Really enjoying it.
And Kieran, you are now MIT guy. If you want to go out and fight crime. Thank you. And I do think it fits in. And it's the same with me. Even though I wasn't a huge fan with it, it did stick with me. I did remember it. I just think I needed a little work experience to really understand what it's all about. And we'll be talking about more of that later this week. Okay, last comment we're going to read. This is from Daniel Onions. Talking about Bartleby, he says, this is one of my favorite stories, so I'm enjoying the coverage. The story has always felt very Dickensian to me. The comedy seems Pickwickian, but there's also an air of an inescapable doom that reminds me of things like The Signalman. Mm. Like The Signalman, Bartleby seems in some weird way to be already dead, which I suppose might be one of the things that the postscript is getting at. And then he says what the postscript is. But you know what? I'm not going to say what it is because that's what we're covering on the next show. Thank you, Daniel. And thank you to everybody for leaving these comments. Insightful, great questions.
Yeah.
This is exciting to be able to directly address them. So please keep writing in, folks, and we'll keep doing this.
We'll keep commenting on the comments.
That's all we've got for this comments show, which I think every time we do this, why don't we pull something out of the comments to name the episode. For this one, I'm calling it Kool-Aid Manning. I think that'll be a good episode title.
I think it's perfect. Good job, Rafe. With that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comment Show.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.